Okay, well, we're all here tonight to learn the deepest, innermost secrets about Cactus Canyon. So I thought that I'd like to start before I introduce you to Matt and Tom. For those of you that don't know, really, just to set a context and to say that Cactus Canyon, in my view at least, is unique in two different senses. First of all, it's the last of what some of you might call the traditional dot matrix games, being the last dot matrix game to come out before the Pinball 2000 series. But something a lot of you might not know is that it was very unique in the way in which Williams went about getting the design of that game. Very briefly, they knew they needed a game before they came out with the first Pinball 2000 game, and they didn't have one. And I'm going to let Matt Coryell and Tom Capira tell you about the selection process and how the game came to be born. So at this stage, I'd like to hand over to you guys.
Okay.
So here you go, Matt.
Okay, we thought we'd start with actually some pictures that kind of talk a little bit about how we came up with the concept, and that should lead into a lot of the questions that you guys might have about the game. And we will certainly get to talking a little bit about how we got formed as a team. And so, do you have anything to add before we start?
Let's go.
Okay. This was a part of the design team. Unfortunately, not everybody that worked on that game is in the picture, but you see Tom and Rob Barry is behind him, and myself and John Yousey. And getting back to part of how this team was formed, this game, we started it without a formal design team. And so the artwork you're going to see was done as a favor. And the dot matrix that we had was done as a favor. And the music we had was done as a favor. And so that was how we got started with Cactus Canyon. Everybody did all their work on speculation that it might get used. So let's go to the next slide and we'll talk a little bit about it. So cut in if you want to.
Yeah.
But this was one of the first concepts for kind of an art package or an art feel for the game. And what you're going to see is it's very different if you've seen the real thing. We have quite a bit of a kind of a saddlebag kind of thing going on here. Real kind of cheesy Western look. We decided this was not kind of the look that you wanted to have in a 1990s pinball machine. So, we had this wood thing, and the part that we zoned in on that we liked was this. Okay? So, we nixed it. We'll go to the next one.
Well, tell them where Cactus Canyon came from.
Okay.
Because that's really that's fun, too.
Yeah. So,
I mean, we had this Western theme, but the title actually came very early. And, Matt and I, we were working together on the game. We knew we wanted to do a game. We put a Whitewood together first before we were actually a game team. And so we were at Matt's house, like a Saturday morning, sitting at his kitchen table, going through what the game's going to do. And we were actually talking about themes. And here's Rob.
Rob!
Come on. Running a little late.
Yeah. Rob is the gentleman who did all of the sounds and music for the game. So this is Rob.
Yeah.
And we'll get him a chair. So anyway, keep
going. So we're sitting around Matt's kitchen table talking through all this, and Matt's wife Stephanie, she's in the kitchen, and we're just talking about all the different kind of games that we could do, and we hadn't even really picked a Western theme yet. We were trying to talk through all the different themes. And then Stephanie came up with the name Cactus Canyon.
Right.
And that's all like, oh, well, now it has to be a Western game.
Yeah, it just stuck.
Yeah.
We had no idea that there was a McDonald's lunchbox called Cactus Canyon.
Can I ask at this stage? So here you are sitting at home designing a game. That's not normally how it starts. Normally it starts, you've got a nice, I'm going back a few years, but when I went into Steve Richards' office for the first time, he had a big board that he was, designing on. Why weren't you doing all this design work at the Williams factory?
Well,
we weren't an official game team at the time. They were looking for a new design team. And so we started working on our own design, and then when we felt we were ready, we were going to say, oh, by the way, we've been working on a game. We'd like to be considered for the position. Here's our game. Would you, take a look at it and consider us for the role? So we were doing all this work in the background, and we had a play field, and we were doing all that, but it wasn't a, you know, it was just a Black Ops kind of product.
Does that explain why it was not licensed? Because you couldn't look at the pool of licenses?
No. We wanted the freedom that a license would allow. Frankly, we wanted the freedom to do something a little more creative, and not to take away from some of the phenomenal licensed games that are there, but we wanted something where we could kind of write our own picture instead of having to worry, you know, what the property would tell us to do. Plus, the time frame was pretty quick.
Yeah, the time frame was quick, and we knew what licenses were available, and we considered several of them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we got stuck on the Western theme, and we had the name, and we just decided that was the game we wanted to do, and decided not to do a license project.
As a matter of fact, when we proposed to Roger Sharp that we were going to do a Western game, he said, "Did you know that Wild West is going to be redone with Will Smith?" Ooh. He said, "No, but that kind of leads credence in having one thing."
Can you clarify? Because I had this image of you being at home doing this speculative work, but you just mentioned you had a time frame. So who would set the deadline?
Well,
I mean, we knew what the time frame was going to be, you know, because there was a standard schedule that most of the games tried to follow, and we knew that they needed a product in that slot, so we knew where we were going to fall.
We had
worked there for years, we knew how the system worked, so we.
And on top of that, pinballs weren't selling particularly well, so we knew the game before us would probably not be winning.
My understanding was that at that time, Williams. We're kind of running a competition to find out.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Okay. Yes.
we'll talk to that a little bit. So, but you know, that to add to a little bit of the flavor of what Tom's talking about, in my office was where we built up the Whitewood after, you know, the initial parts were put together. And
right, Matt was still working in gaming.
Yeah.
Right.
So he had gone to the gaming side, and so we had started talking, and he's like, you know, I'd rather do pinball than gaming, and I'm like, well, maybe we should try doing this thing on the side and see if we can make it work.
So can I ask, what were you both doing? You were in gaming doing what?
I was working on the slot machine operating system.
So you're a software guy?
Yeah.
Right. And so?
Well, I'm a mechanical engineer and designer. I was with George Gomez for years, and I worked on his game.
Okay, yep. So you're both within Williams?
Yeah.
Right. We had both been there 5 years, 4 years. We'd been there long.
And at this point, Rob, you're not in the picture.
Well,
we recruited.
Shortly into it, yeah.
Okay.
You remember, I was telling you, everything was about favorites, right? So we went to Rob and said, Rob, can you give me some music?
We're putting a Whitewood together. We need, like, a song so it feels good. Could you put a little something together for us?
Yeah, we did talk about characters as well, too.
Yeah, we did.
Some of the voices were going to be and some of the flavor of some of the... They mentioned Bard Brothers, and so I started thinking about... voices and a friend of mine who's in town here by the name of Mark McClain, a voiceover guy, and he and I had known each other for now over 30 years, and so he ended up being the voice of this character where I said, well, let's do, I talked to John Yossi and we joked around and said, let's Mayor Dewey Cheatham, because we always heard you love Dewey Cheatham and Howe, and so he said, let's do come up with a Mayor Cheatham and come up with characters, you know, that go along with that. Some of them didn't get fleshed out as much. They kind of got fleshed out to all of us, and maybe didn't get fleshed out in the game. That there was a narrator that you hear that's through the game. You know, some of the other characters that I think we're going to have maybe more visuals, but I think the essence of the voices was there. So.
Yeah, and he absolutely positively nailed John Wayne.
Yes, and Mark McClain, it was only about two or three people that did all the voices, and then two female voices, one a friend of Matt's, and then one a professional a female voice person to be the other female voice.
The professional one, the professional voice, by the way, absolutely hilarious, because her normal voice,
right?
You would never believe this woman was a voice artist. I mean, okay. She just had the most bizarre, strange, screechy voice. Do you remember that? And we said, she nailed Rosie, right? And we're thinking now, if you could speak like that, wouldn't you normally do that? It's bad. So let's go through the slideshow a little bit more.
So we started there.
Okay. And then, so after we walked through, I think we missed one. Go back when it probably changed while we were chatting here.
Oh.
So this was a second generation. And one of the things that I had was I had this T-shirt that had a lizard on it. And I said, lizards are cool, right? Lizards are cool. I want to see a lizard. And it'll kind of hip up the game a little bit. So this was, that element got added. We still didn't like the whole saddlebag font thing. And then we went to John, that's the actual picture of the first pencil sketch of the Cactus Canyon logo. And that stylized the whole thing. So we wanted something that was modern, but not goofy Western stuff. There's a little bit of silliness, right? See the cactus kind of dodging out of the way. So it had to have a flavor of a little bit of silliness, but not cheesy Western stuff.
Anything to add?
Okay. No, and then that's the actual cabinet side.
Well, it's close. Again, this was the next cut, but you're going to notice that, okay, there's a little bit of cheese going on here, right? We've got this hat thing, and we don't have the cool lizard that I insisted that I really wanted. And so it was close. And then the next is...
Hang on. Not the lizard. This is your guy.
Well, this was... If you just go to the next picture, you'll see.
It's an evolution.
It's an evolution.
Okay? It changes.
This is an actual picture. This is only... It's an 18-inch pencil sketch. If you can believe it, this is the pencil sketch that John Yossi used to put together his art package from. Okay? All I can tell you is I've never worked with someone in any field that's as talented as John is, just coming up with stuff, and he's just amazing. So, and this was all done as a favor, which is the thing that I love the best about it. So, anything to add to it?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll take you through the front cabinet. Again, you can see some of the elements that we've talked about before. And then that is the pencil sketch for the final artwork. Okay. Yeah, it's barbed wire in there. He had come up with a really cool way of doing the denim. He like painted with cheesecloth in front of the airbrush. It was really cool. So, okay, next one. Now this is the side cabinet art, and this was his first cut at it. This came in that same era where we had that, this hat thing going on. And we decided that this was just a little too goofy, and if you could read the handwriting, it actually says this is just a little too silly, right? And then the final one is this is a preliminary against the pencil sketch with type added to it for the side art. Okay. So we'll probably pause here for a second. You want to talk a little bit? This is really the first CAD drawing we had, right?
Right. This is how we start a lot of the game. So this is a CAD drawing. It's the play field. You can see a lot of the mechs are in on the top of the play field. This one, I can't see. This one's Club the Barn.
Yes.
So.
Yep. We'll talk about it in the next slide.
Okay. There's a better slide. So this is where we're starting to box out the rules. Here's the play field. We can talk about what the shots are. And on the left there, we're writing, okay, how's it going to play? How's it going to flow? What are the rules going to do? And then, you know, we see we're penciling in names that go on all on the inserts.
And the next slide, you're going to see it's the same play field. We're going to zoom in on a part of the play field that changed very dramatically after the first round. Yeah.
So what was your thinking about the humor component at this time? You committed to a lot of humor or a little humor? Or where were you on the humor part?
It had to be humor, yeah. Yeah, it had to be. I mean, that's one of the things that's, I don't know how easy it is to do, but you have to have it. So, and Rob helped out a lot with that stuff. So, like the voice of the drunk. This is our drunk guy.
So. Years and years ago, many, many moons ago.
Lots of practice, apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
So. Okay, let's go to the next slide. We'll talk a little bit about it. You want to point out some of the features?
Yeah, so here you can see up on the upper right-hand corner. Originally, we had a set of barn doors, and you would hit the barn doors, and the barn doors were, you know, like they were like saloon doors. They would open. And we had a mech, and they would actually, you'd hit them, and they would pop open, and then that would give you access into the trap.
Ramp configuration is a little different.
Yeah, we had a center ramp for the longest time. We wanted a center ramp. We had a center ramp. You'd shoot up the center. It would divide, go left and right. And we fought that for a really long time. And we
couldn't get it to work.
We got it to the point where it didn't work bad. But that means it didn't work great, and we kept fighting it,
Fighting with each other.
Yeah, and then so finally one day we're everybody's in and we're having a review and we're shooting it. And Larry's flipping it. And he's like, it's better, but it's just not right. And we're like, we know, we you know, he's like, well, what are you going to do when it doesn't work? And I'm like, oh, well, we'll make a right-hand ramp here and a left-hand ramp there, and we'll be done. And he's like, well, then why don't you just do it? Why are you goofing around? And you know, we're like, all right, about a week later, we took it out, gave it up, and ended up with the configuration we had. So.
But other than that, the first whitewood and the final product were actually fairly similar, a lot closer than a lot of the other whitewoods that I'd had in other products. So,
so these are the hand grips for the guns that are on the arch. The ones on the two sides are the actual cast tools that were sculpted. So Dave Link did all our sculpture, and he sculpted the handles, and then he poured these urethanes. And then what you see there is actually a hand-painted urethane in the center. That's actually not one of the molded pieces. And so we have a lot of that. We're going to show you all the tooling that was done and all the unique parts that Dave did. So those are the first two hand grips. These again are proto hand grips, right?
These are actually off of my game that was in my office.
Next one. These are the beer mugs on there, and so these are the first. You can see that, you know, the tooling dust on them from when he pulled them out of the rubber when he molded them. So these are the beer mugs. If you go to the next one, this one,
yeah,
go one more. So this one actually has a hook on it. Because originally, the beer mugs, you would hit them and they would fall back.
Then they'd reset.
And then they'd reset. We'd hit a popper and they would reset. And this is another thing that we struggled with for a while. It didn't have a lot of visual effect when you hit it. They were relatively small. And we went round and round. And then finally, we removed the hook and we put them on the pins and they worked like the spiders from Scared Stiff.
Yeah, the frogs.
The
yeah.
frogs.
Yeah. I mean, they worked. They physically worked, but they didn't work. You know, just was one of those ideas you got to kill. So those are actually hand painted beer mugs.
Yeah, those are cast beer mugs.
Okay, so the drop targets. We can probably spend a few minutes on the drop targets. So these drop targets that you're seeing here in the next picture, I'll give them a better close up. Those are actually hand drawn stickers that were stuck on the first prototype machine. And they look absolutely fantastic on a whiteboard with no artwork behind it. Absolutely awesome. And someplace in this world are, I think, what, 25 sets of these that were actually made as decals?
Yeah, we had decals.
And I don't have any of them.
I don't either. I don't know where they are.
Okay, so the problem, though, if anybody can imagine what happens once you paint a play field.
It gets busy.
You can't see
it. Starts getting really busy.
They get lost. Okay, we went round and round and...
Well, and what we really originally had in the original design, we actually had clear drop targets in yellow.
No, that was second generation.
No, they started with them.
Really?
Yeah, we started with the clear yellow, and we wanted to light the yellow targets. So the targets would come up, and they were clear, and they would illuminate, and that's how you would see them. But they were made out of a different material, so they could be clear versus the black ones. And we went round and round with... I think we had four or five different versions of the material, and we could not get them to pass life tests. Sooner or later, we could crack them.
Well, actually, you even changed the tool.
Yeah.
I remember we changed the tool, tried to get stronger.
I don't think I told anybody I changed the tool.
We
did everything we could to get it to work, because we really wanted them to glow. We wanted them to, you know, the tops were wide, and they would glow in the playfield, and when they came up, they'd be illuminated, and you'd see them, and they, you know, we thought that was just the coolest thing, and we struggled with that for a very long time.
The whole idea of putting the pop-ups in the middle of the play field, that was something we came up with that we didn't know that anybody had ever done before, and we just thought it was kind of neat. And so this was kind of an integral part of the game. We thought, you're going to be shooting bad guys as they pop up. So anyway, I thought these were kind of cool to bring and show, because some people I know have rumored that there were artwork for the targets, and we took them off for a reason. Excellent.
This is the hat, and again, there's the actual first molding sample, and then a real hat next to it, before it's painted. So Cactus Canyons have these plates, the serial number plates, looks like that, and the plates are numbered 1 through 925. And the original plan was that every cactus would go out with a plate that matched its serial number. So what these are. These are color samples that we ran trying to decide what this plate should look like. So once we had we had several different designs of what this thing should be. We narrowed it down so that it would be this serial plate. After we did the serial plate, we took some of the raw castings and we finished them in different ways, trying to find a finish that we'd like that would stand out through the game. And these are the different versions that we had. And the black and the dark color, basically what we did is, you know, the plate's aluminum, and then we anodized it, and then we sanded across the top of the letters to get the letters, you know, to come through. You can see on the black that there was a lot of porosity in the tooling when we made these parts. So we were, although we really liked that look, we were worried that, you know, we'd end up going through 4,000 plates before we got 1,000 of them that didn't look like that. And that's kind of how that went away. The one in the lower right-hand corner, we really liked that, the darker color with the canyon, you know, exposed so that it would look nice. In the end, we ran them all gold just because there was a lot of, you know, there was the porosity. This is how they turned out when we were all done. But that's sort of the way the plate came to be.
Okay.
True that those plates never actually made it onto the machines?
Well, the plates actually showed up late. So the machines were made, and a lot of them were shipped. And then we sent them. The plates were to be sent to the distributors who had the games. And we went through a lot of gymnastics trying to find which distributors had which serial numbers, and then we sent them all. And a lot of them, I mean, they were all shipped to the distributors, but a lot of them, tell the story. So here's a story we heard about an hour ago.
So the plates were about 300 games shipped to Europe, and they were sent to Nova Games, which was the distributor in Germany. And so they came, and the games were already distributed and during Germany and all over Europe. So they just got it, and they did not know what to do with them, and so they just trashed them all.
Oh.
And so finally, we had really a lucky day that our friend took a look into the trash bin and found them and recovered them, so they were saved. Fortunately, so this is one of these. So and at least the owners in Germany and Europe, they can get when Steve Stefan has them all at home, so they can get them. So, but this, I think this is kind of typical. But what happened with these things?
Yeah, well, I'm glad somebody got them. Cool.
Yeah, we don't know how many actually ended up on games.
Yeah.
So there's some right now. People on RGP is still trying to get them matched up.
So
I have this plate number if someone has the game.
At least if somebody has a game, I can give you the mail address later from Stefan, and he can look whether he has a fitting plate of your game or not.
So if someone has the game and they don't have the plate, how, because I don't understand the way that the serial numbers were issued, how would you know from the serial number which of the 925 games you had?
The last three digits of the serial number.
Yes, the last three digits.
So, but I had seen the list of the ones sent to Nova Games. There were definitely several ranges of numbers. So
yeah.
It seemed there was really somebody looking which games were shipped to Germany.
Okay.
Yeah, they were supposed to try to match them all up, and a lot of them ended up in the trash.
So if you have them, they're probably pretty rare. But we'll hang on to them. I'll figure out how to put my kids through college. If you want. So... this picture here is Rob at his best. Tom wearing a couple of horns. That is actually the night that we put our game out on test the very first time. And there are a few people missing from the picture, but got most of the team there. So we'll go to the next one. And this kid has no idea how famous he is at the moment, but that's the first paid credit for our game ever. And he looks like he's ready to go. He's got a baseball glove on. And he thinks that's cool. So that's the first coin in. Followed by the second coin in. So it was just kind of fun. So I think I have first coin in pictures of every game I've worked on.
What location is this?
I can't remember the name of the place. It's it was a family restaurant kind of bar place in Crystal Lake. Okay. And as far as I know, that was the first time that Williams had tested a game at that location. It was just someplace I drove by and said, that looks like a reasonable place. They had some games there, so we put it there.
And this was during the time you still worked there?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that date doesn't make sense.
Yeah, this is a different set of pictures. So we've now transitioned to my basement where I have had two Cactus Caymans. The one here on the right that you're seeing the picture of is actually the prototype that was in my office. That was the very first whitewood that came out of our prototype lab. Or not whitewood, but the first built-up part out of our lab. And I brought
the
just
art color is different.
Yeah.
The art is different.
Yeah, the art is different because you're not looking at a production translight, so it kind of looks a little more orangey, but it's supposed to look the same. So go to the next one. So really, the reason I brought these along is to kind of show, it's going to be really hard to make out, but if you kind of look here, you see these drop targets are this one and this one, they're orange. See, that one's kind of whitish. But these are the lit-up drop targets that we tried to put into the game that we really wished had worked out. Okay. So if you go to the next one, I've just got a couple of pictures that only a pinball geek would like me. So if you look, this little lamp is mounted under the playfield and is actually trying to illuminate the drop targets. This is underneath the playfield looking up. And just a couple of pictures of the other drop targets to show the same thing.
And they lit up well.
Oh, they
just
they
didn't
were
last
great.
That long.
You know, if you had a box full of drop targets, it was a great feature. If you didn't have a box full of drop targets, you'd be money ticked off in 3 weeks. So anyway, I saved them. I saved a handful of drop targets. I'll probably retrofit my real game with them at some point. And so that kind of ends the slideshow. We'll kind of open it up, and I think we need to get back to kind of the question how the team was formed and some of the other questions, but that kind of does.
So the story I heard, maybe you can, you know, because the thing about pinball and coming to Expo over the years, I hear lots of stories, and then you go to someone else. Well, I was working at the factory then, and they've got a slightly different take on it. And so if I can tell you very briefly what I understand, then you can perhaps set us all straight. I understand that Williams needed a game because the first Pinball 2000 game, for example, they actually changed. Revenge from Mars wasn't actually the first design for Pinball 2000. And because schedules had slipped, they needed another game to slide in. And they didn't have any designers available because everyone was working on Pinball 2000.
I'd say there's elements of truth to that,
okay.
But it's not exactly straight now.
So
anybody got a better rumor?
Okay. So they decided this was an opportunity for some new people to design them.
I'll let you fill in your details. But, you know.
Yes, they were looking for a new designer to run a new team.
Right. And I understand they had some sort of competition.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about how that?
Yeah.
Well, all right, so my version of the story is, so they were looking for another game team. They were looking for a designer. Matt and I started talking about trying to put together a team and do a game. So we were working in the dark. No one knew that we were working on a game. And that's where, you know, we had gone to like Rob and John and go, hey, you know, we're putting together this whitewood. Could you help us fill out the whitewood a little bit so that it looks right and it plays right, because we're gonna go ask for that job. And when we go, we want to take a whitewood that somebody can flip and they can see what we can do and why we should
be given the
opportunity to do that. And we wanted a game that you could flip and play, and we wanted sound, and we wanted a little bit of an art package. And we had, you know, it worked, it operated, Matt had tools in it, or rules in it. But no one knew we were working on that. So
at the time, there was one person.
What?
See, at the time I was working on slot machines.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't let my boss in my office anymore.
Right, right. Well, because he was in working on gaming stuff. We just locked it in his room, and
right.
He was kind of off in the corner.
Not getting
like,
right
out of the out of the mainstream. So no one knew we had this thing. We had to get Wally to route the playfield for us a couple of times, and you know,
yep.
We paid him with beer, and he was great with that. And he did rent it at night for us and stuff, and we did all that. So we showed up, and we're like, hey, we want to do a game. We want to be considered for the position. Here, why don't you come to Matt's office? We want to show you what we want to do. And we brought everybody in. We're like, here's the game. Flip it. And they're like, where did this come from? And we're like, oh, you know, we just put this together in our spare time. And they flipped it. So they were also looking at other people at the same time, but no one had a whitewood. We were the only ones with a whitewood. So that's how a competition sort of happened.
Who,
and what happened.
Who were the other people?
Well, Mark Wayna. Mm-hmm. And... Scott Solmione,
right.
And there was a fourth one.
No, I think there was a fourth. Anybody remember if there was a fourth team?
Wasn't
Dwight,
there a fourth
you remember?
Doug Watson, that's right.
Did a conceptual drawing, didn't have anything.
Petrovsky had one too.
That's right.
That's why.
That's right, Petrovsky. Right.
So other people had.
Yeah, they were all internal.
They weren't looking at anyone outside the company at that stage?
Not at that time, okay. I don't think so.
So other people had sketches and art packages and said, you know, here's what it would look like, but we were the only ones that had a flippable whiteboard. So then they said, well, all right, everybody take, I don't know, it was like 3 weeks or a month or something, everybody go build a whiteboard. And so everybody did. And so all the game teams got time to put together a whiteboard.
And what was the budget for that?
I have no idea.
They said that they thought on what you could spend.
Spare parts in the
box. Yeah, it was whatever you could cajole out of people in the building. I mean, you know, you could use parts of the parts bin, or, you know, if you happen to know the guys in the model shop like Tom did, you could get some parts made.
Did you have access to stores and unlimited amounts of whatever?
Well, you had access to the model shop and
there
the
used
tool
to be
maker.
Literally bins of parts. There was a place where prototype games, you know, and you could walk in and there would be bins of parts all the way back to God knows when dirt was created kind of stuff, you know,
right. All
the way up to the modern stuff. So you just go and start pulling parts out. So
okay.
It wasn't hard to get, like, bumpers and stuff. The hard part was, like, that barn door Mac we talked about.
That
had to be fab.
The new stuff.
Yeah, right. The new stuff was where we had to spend a lot more energy.
And then ramps were just, you know, the plastic cut.
That's right.
You know, cut flat pieces of butyrate. Together.
That's right.
Right, and the guys in the model shop, if you gave them a print, they would do that. They would cut the plastic and glue it together and stretch it. I mean, this is,
yeah,
you know.
So, I mean, we had the same tools that any other design team would have at their disposal. It was just unsanctioned at first, and then afterwards it was, you know, kind of sanctioned. So,
So that's kind of how the whole thing. So that everybody put together whiteboards, and then they, you know, they had a, you know, the management went around and they flipped all the games and.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of it, we got chosen to go ahead and finish our game. And so
we had a cool gunfight.
So, yeah, we had
the best part.
Did you know that this was going to be the last Dot Matrix game?
When the design team was formed, I don't think that was the case. No, but clearly within a short amount of time, it was clear. You know, but when it started, I think the difference between your part of the story and the way I remember it was we needed an additional design team, not a placeholder design team. Because games were running shorter, all the design cycles had to be shorter.
And this, presumably, just thinking of time frames, would have been maybe, what, the late 97 onwards?
Yeah. It would have been,
the game came out
it would have been mid to late 97.
Right. And the game came out in 98, and The Adventure from Mars was launched in January of 99.
Yeah. So it was really about trying to have enough design teams to keep the assembly line fed, because you can't let the cash cow stop moving.
Any questions at this stage?
You said 9:25. Did you know going in there was going to be 9:25? Or did...
No, we didn't. That came much later.
Yep.
And one thing is the beard mug supposed to hit the glass or not?
It does. That wasn't the original design, but it does.
Yeah, that wasn't on purpose. No.
It was supposed to fall over in the back on the original design, and then when we put the shaft on it so it would jump. Yeah, it does. If you hit it hard, it will.
Yep.
I got a question for Tom. Do you think that now, with the materials available now, you could do that, illuminate a drop target? And is there a better plastic that might hold up?
There are. There's stuff now that we could probably get it to live in the environment that it's in.
It's not easy.
No, it's not easy. And what we, you know, the drop targets are nylon, and we tried to run them in polycarbonate. And there's now plasticizers you can put polycarbonate to make them more ductile. And you know, like the technology you find on bumpers of cars nowadays are much more, you know, they're way better than they were 10, 15 years ago.
Hey, who wants an illuminated bumper on their car?
But can we do it today? Probably.
It's still, you know, life testing stuff is hard. It's really hard. You know, I had to make a test fixture for this game that all it did was sit there and shoot the ball at the drop target. Day in, day out.
It's such a cool idea, but I got to agree, you did
it
the right
really
thing
cool.
by not doing it.
Yeah.
Matt, is there something in the software for illumination? Is it something in?
No, they ran off of the same, they were wired in parallel with the same lights that flash in front, the arrows that flash in front. So when I laid out the switch, or the light matrix, I made sure that I could double up those lights without overloading the system.
So as designing the current game, is the mod ever came along?
Mm-hmm. Yep, good.
So we've got a stage now where your game's been chosen, and presumably now, were you then allowed to spend 100% of your time developing
the
game?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Rob, what were you doing immediately prior to sort of getting deeply involved in this?
I had worked on Circus Voltaire.
Okay.
And I had been with the company for about 1 year. Prior to that, I had done several things in the Chicago area, including I was in the advertising music world and had done commercials for everything from McDonald's to Captain Crunch cereal to that, a lot of other things. I knew a lot of people in the voice business here in town. And more and more, we were starting to see that becoming more popular in games, as well as in the gaming side, as that's becoming nowadays. We use live musicians and have a recording studio at Nova's WMS Gaming, and use a lot of live voice talent and that kind of thing. Prior to that, I was working on Circus Voltaire, which I considered that was my first game, and I was a pinball novice. But thought it was a decent game, but really was able to sink my teeth into Cactus Canyon and was pleased with it. So.
Okay, now I'm trying to think what was going on in the late 90s, and I'm guessing that the time you were doing this, Williams had already ceased doing pinball stuff in North California, and you're out at Waukegan by now.
Right. Yep.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, you know, as a.
You can add to this, but I think moving to Waukegan made it a very difficult thing, you know, because when we used to go in the morning, you'd walk past the line on your way to the office, you know, and you'd walk past the line on your way to lunch, and you'd walk past the line on your way back, and part of it was seeing the game going, wow, it's coming, or watching the game before you come off the line and go, oh, crap, I got to be done next week, you know, that kind of stuff, but also, I remember when we were working on World Cup Soccer, I remember walking down the line, and there was a guy putting in screws in the wrong place, and I said, what are you doing? You know, can you show me why you're putting them in that way? And it turned out it was just the easiest way for him to do it. But the poppers were all in the wrong place. So, you know, it allowed you to kind of walk the line and see things. I mean,
right.
I'm sure you had similar experiences.
It did, especially coming out of the engineering side. We would go down there, you know, once a day, twice a day, just looking for problems, making sure the line was running right, making sure things were going together the right way, and, you know, talking with the line supervisors. And it added a sense of quality to the game, because you could stop in. You know, you didn't have to drive to go see there. You didn't have to make an appointment. It was just something you did every day as you walked by. And everybody did it. I mean,
yeah.
It wasn't just the engineer on the job, but everybody did it. And so that helped, you know. And then when they moved it off to Waukegan, they still had a very competent staff. I mean,
yeah.
We're not saying that
absolutely.
That's not the case. It's just, it separated the design from the manufacturer.
Okay. So you've taken us through kind of the timeline from being aspirational pinball designers to actually doing things in secret and moving on, and finally you get the green light, go ahead, you design your game, it's on the production line.
Yep.
What happens from now on? What's the story from, say, well, from there till today?
Are you going to make me answer first?
You go first.
Okay. I would say...
Yeah,
you go first. Yeah.
In terms of the pinball,
what are you doing now?
Right now, I stayed with WMS Gaming. I am the lead composer. We now make. It was a sad day when pinball said bye bye at Williams in October.
I guess it was
of '99, and I stayed with them and continued and. And now I'm lead composer for six other composers at WMS. We have an exclusive relationship with the Bose Corporation. We're actually now making games in surround and have a chair, a surround chair with speakers. They're behind the player. Our first license was Top Gun. Which features flybys while people are winning money, as well as surround sound mixes of danger zone that we did here with local musicians and vocalists. And so we're continuing to make gaming products, and as I said before, have a full recording studio on staff at the, it's called the Technology Campus, at still at 3401 North California.
For my part, I think there was, you asked, like, when did we know that, or somebody asked how many machines we were going to have.
Right.
You know, we went in thinking, you know, this is going to be another design team. Yeah, things aren't good, but it'll bounce.
Because I guess even in those days at Williams, 925 games is a very low production run.
Yep.
I mean, I guess, you know, that they wouldn't have, I think the management policy at the time was typically to do a run of sort of 3,000 and during that time kind of get a feel for how the market responded and deciding how far
to go on there. Yeah, it's a little painful to think you only ran 925 and compare it to some of the other games.
But you've got to design a game.
Absolutely. So. You know, I wouldn't trade any of it. It was absolutely a phenomenal experience. But for me personally, you could tell halfway into this, that about halfway into the design cycle, I think it was pretty clear that we were going to be the last game. Pin 2000 concepts were brewing about the same time as we started to come along. Might have been within 2 or 3 months from that's when George Gomez, you know, ginned up the 2000 mm-hmm. concept with, you know, with the tube, and so we knew it was pretty much the end. And coincident with that, my first daughter was born, and I started to reprioritize what I wanted to do with my life. Working 100 hours a week was not necessarily a good thing to do anymore.
So you changed your own goals.
And so I started looking for a new job. You know, not too long before the game went out.
Okay. So. And what did you move into?
Okay, so it was time to get a real job, as it were. And so I went back to. I work for Lexmark right now, and I'm a manager. I have a group that designs ASIC and firmware and cards and controllers and power supplies and just about anything electrical that goes on inside a laser printer.
Okay.
So it started winding down. Pin 2000 was coming along. We were finishing up Cactus. And so they asked me to go across the street to Midway Games and run the engineering group over there. So I actually did that. I was a mechanical engineering manager at Midway Games for 2 years.
And what were Midway Games making?
We were making the video games at the time, Hydro Thunder.
Okay.
So
still coin-op stuff?
Yeah, it was still the coin-op. It was just the video video arm of the coin-op company, which is literally across the street from the 3401 building. So I was there for a few years, and then I went in back to the gaming group and started the Top Box Studio, which the Top Boxes are the fancy tops that go on top of slot machines. They're always themed, so the Monopoly tops, the Clint Eastwood tops, the Men in Black tops, Survivor, what else did we do? All the Hollywood Squares. So I went over there and I ran a design group over there. We started, it was me and Brad Cornell, who's an ex-pinball guy, and actually, I just left that about a month ago, and when I left, we had 15 engineers and artists and stuff in that group. And so that group has designed all the premier product for WMS Gaming for the last 6 years. So
I guess a question for all of you is, did your involvement in pinball design end with Cactus Canyon, or did you get to participate in Pinball 2000?
I didn't participate in Pinball 2000 at all.
I
was involved, heartbreakingly, in the very last game with Pat Lawler, which was to be called, I guess, was Wizard Blocks.
That wasn't the last game. There were three other games, I think, in development beyond that.
There might have been, yeah. But that was the game when the axe came down.
Right,
we had
done.
We were just both saying, man, this is going to be a killer game.
Right, I mean, that game actually went to the mail, didn't it?
Yeah,
didn't
it did.
Went to what?
Oh, yeah. Part of the engineering process, it goes through what we would call the MEL lab. It was the Manufacturing Excellence Lab. And what it really was is we would build 15 prototypes.
Okay.
So after the Whitewoods were done, and you'd have, hopefully Whitewood 3, more likely Whitewood 12 or 13, you'd finish up the you'd try to finish up the documentation, and we would run a mini run of 15 units.
Okay.
And those were the MEL games. And the unit that Matt showed you the picture of, the one that was from his office, that was part of those MEL games, and we would call them MEL games,
okay.
And there was 15 of them.
Well,
Gene Cunningham is now the owner of the Wizard Blocks prototype, and I think he's got three different whiteboards for it, three iterations of that.
Yeah, there's several cactus whitewoods that ended up in the dumpster in the back hall.
Yeah.
As we were working, we would just, all right, we're done with this one. We drag it out, throw it in the dumpster, start on the new one. So, I mean, that happened all the time. It
kills people to find that out. But,
but at some point, you had so much garbage in your office, you had to throw stuff in the dumpster.
Yeah.
So, question.
Since you were cut short, what is your most annoying idea or feature that you didn't get to put into the game? And what do you think is the most satisfying part of the game from your
viewpoint? No, you gotta focus.
Yeah.
I think we know what that is.
Tom's deferring to me. Yeah, let me start by saying I'm really actually pretty proud of the game. Am I disappointed about things? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but I'm really proud of it. And the thing that I really like the best of all the design teams that I work with, I'm not trying to take away any of the other ones, it was probably the most fun design team I worked with because everybody got along really, really well. We kind of treat everybody as equals. I mean, Rob was in every design meeting that we had. You know, some other design teams, the sound guy was not always brought in. Our dot matrix guy came in when we were working on rules. It was a very tight-knit group, and it was a lot of fun. So I really don't have any regrets about what came out. But then again, when I start playing, you know, the rule set is fairly shallow. It didn't get finished out. It needed a few more weeks to be worked on. So I think it really has to do with just knowing that a good player, a reasonably good player, is going to see the end of the game long before they should have. I think that's the only thing that I really kind of regret.
So who is responsible for the game software?
Me.
So is the game software that you run on your machine at home the same version that anyone can download from the website?
I double-checked that with him yesterday. Because I wanted to make sure his and mine matched.
Right. And the answer is?
I don't know.
what are you getting?
Who's asking?
I remember
I was talking about my kids' college fund, right?
Okay. Well, there are games that software development continued after Williams were no longer in the Pinball game.
Yeah.
And generally, I think it's acknowledged that the software was incomplete in the latest official release. So I guess what I'm asking for people that have got games at home, is there a better version of the software? It's the first question. And the second question, of course, is it available to them?
Yeah. Well, a couple things. One is, I left Williams.
Uh-huh.
I left WMS. That code is not my property. That code is the property of WMS. So for me to distribute it would not be proper. Okay, now, has it been done by other people? Perhaps, but I didn't feel that was my place to do that. So that was part of it. And the other part of it is, you know, there are some things that you go through in life and you just have to appreciate what you did. Okay? There's a lot there that I can be very appreciative of, even if it's not finished. And so for me personally, you know, yeah, I wish I had some time to spend on it, but
that's not your priority.
That's not my priority right now.
Okay. See? So you're not going to get contributions to the kids' college fund,
I'll find someplace else.
Okay. I guess another question that people often like to know the answer to when it comes to designers is what pin tables maybe have influenced them, what do they admire, and what have they got in their own homes?
You have a first?
I have two Corvettes, a Johnny, an NBA, a Playboy, the new Playboy, George's Playboy, a Cactus, a Hydro Thunder, a 39-inch Hydro Thunder, which takes up my whole living room.
Yeah, that's practical.
A Galaga. Well, all right, so that's a funny story. We would take our prototypes home. That's why we have prototypes. That's why Matt has the prototype. Well, when I was across the street in gaming, we did the same thing. We would take prototypes home. So it was time for me to take one of the video games home. And there was a 25-inch Hydro Thunder and a 39-inch Hydro Thunder. And I called home, and I'm like, honey, I'm going to bring home a Hydro Thunder. There's a 25-inch and a 39-inch, you know, 39-inch with the big chair and all that stuff. And, you know, what do you think? Which one should I bring home? And she's like, well, we don't have room for either one, so you might as well bring the big one. So I did. So she truly understands, you know, why I do the things I do. And of course, that's why I'm still married.
She understands.
She understands. So that's what I am.
Okay. So what I have versus what necessarily inspired me is maybe a little different. But my first game that I bought was High Speed. And I looked for that game. That was, I didn't know much about where to find them or anything. So that was kind of my introduction to getting taken on the price of a pinball machine. But I did buy that when I got out of college. And I played that for a good long time. And then, so if I walk, I have to do this by mentally walking through my basement here. So I've got World Cup 94, High Speed, No Fear, Dirty Harry, Jackbot, Getaway, Cactus Canyon, Flash, Corvette, Safecracker, and a couple of video games. So, and I think all of them, I liked a lot of different games. If I look back at before I knew who all the designers were and all that kind of stuff, or I just enjoyed the games and didn't think about who designed stuff, I gravitated a lot towards Pat Lawler games and Steve Ritchie games. And they're very different kinds of games, but I loved High Speed. I loved Black Knight. When I was a kid, I used to, go play Black Knight. That was a fun game. And I loved Earthshaker. That was one of those games that, to this day, there are two games I wish I had in my collection that I don't have. One is Earthshaker, and one is Funhouse. So someday I'll try to find those two.
I was such a pin novice coming in that Cactus Canyon was a lot of fun for me because I really had delved deeply into saying that I was going to make something that was going to be something that I would love to have at home, which was one of the main reasons I still make fun games and try to with the gaming stuff. I just have two games, Circus Voltaire and Cactus Canyon. Felt that in doing it, we did put a lot of time into it and had a lot of fun while we were doing it, and a lot of laughter and in the recording sessions. And my friend Mark McClain and I did a bulk of the voices and a lot of creative time and that kind of thing. So I will say that the team did put me through the paces, as I remember. With versions of some of the tunes for some of the rounds that I would not even I wouldn't go that far this today with any creative team. I think it was 15 versions of the Showdown tune. I mean, it was literally I'd come back with a song and they'd say, I don't think so, right? But we'll know it when we hear it, Would you get, could you be a little more vague than that,
Matt's, because Matt said it, for 3 weeks straight. It needs to be more Big Sky. Big Sky.
Yeah,
Big
Sky. Big
Sky. And we both look at each other and go, what the hell is Big Sky?
Right.
Big Sky. Make it Big Sky.
Big Valley. Let's dance it, All right. Okay. So finally, but once it finally all came together, it really was. And to this day, I have a son who at the time was I'm trying to think 98. He would have been 9 years old and is now a senior in high school. And he and his friends have played this game throughout and loved it. And it's fun to find when they come, especially the high school friends, to when they come and find out that. That Evan's dad has done the music to it, and a number of the voices, they'll ask to hear some of them, and that kind of thing too. So
that's why you're still in practice.
Yeah, I'll tell myself on one thing. I remember one very distinct time when I was sitting in Rob's office, and I did think he was going to kill me. So we're sitting there, and I'm trying to come up with the sound that you get when you over the drop or the rollover lanes at the top. You remember that discussion?
Oh yeah.
And so I'm trying to tell him, I want it to go down when you go down, I want it to go up when you go up, and then I want it to, do this thing when you're complete. And we're talking about it, he's not quite getting it, and finally I go, ta-da. He goes, oh, you mean ta-da, why didn't you just say that? We've been talking about it for like half an hour. And I thought he was going to kill me. That's what we call in the music industry, is ta-da. Gotcha.
Okay, so all three of you, currently on Cactus Canyon.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What serial numbers? And have you got your plaques?
I have my plaque.
To tell you the truth, I do not know my serial number. I'm going to go home and look at it now. So it was one of the first few, I think.
Mm-hmm. I have serial number 2 and a plaque for number 3 that was a game that I actually gave my parents.
I have a...
Yeah, how many do you have?
I've got a couple plaques. And I think the cactus is it's 1. It's,
mm-hmm.
I think the cactus is 1. Most of my games are 5. I always took serial number 5.
Okay.
So I have a whole series of number 5s. But I think cactus I ended up with 1.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Questions?
Tell something about the Bionic part. I think this is the only game that has something on the instruction card that is not implemented in the software at all.
Oh, yeah. I wish we could have done Bionic.
Yeah,
We actually
had
some
really
good
sound for Bionic.
Yeah.
We had a great sound. We had a great. I had taken a voice where we had done a written some speech that was, you know, we'd done it all like Arnold, you know, and so it was going to be, the Dotmation was going to actually be like a Terminator type with like a mock of Terminator with like tire treads or kind of tank tire treads that would come along, you know, and so we had a lot of, we'd done a lot of speech for it, et cetera, and it was one of those things that unfortunately kind of got pushed aside.
There's some, cause didn't you give me a set of ROMs, a new set of ROMs, way back when? And there's some Bionic ROMs.
Well,
there was Bionic.
The sounds are still in ROMs, actually. But the what ended up happening, okay, so it was a combination of things. It was the scorecard, or the rules card, got prototyped up before the rules are done, okay? So that's part number 1. Part number 2 is you got to try a rule and make sure it's fun before it goes out, right? Well, we kind of failed at that part, because we did actually try some Bionic Bart rules, and they all sucked. Really bad, actually. And so, yeah, we wanted to get back and put in some unsuck rules, but just never got there. Okay, now the problem was, rule card never got updated. Okay, when you're downstaffing the entire pinball department, those kind of things get overlooked sometimes. So that's,
I mean,
you know,
it was a pretty crazy time.
It was a crazy, crazy time. If that's the biggest miss we had, we did pretty good for what was going on at the time.
Okay.
Other questions?
Some other hands up. Someone's changed their mind. Okay, Martin.
Did you ever think about a video mode in that game? Or are you against video modes in pinball games?
I don't
know. Not a big fan of video
modes. I'm not a big fan of video modes. We talked about it a bit. Part of the problem with the video modes, I mean, they're pretty cool. Like, I wrote the Star Trek video mode, and I thought that was pretty fun, and some of the other guys have done some really good ones. Brian Eddy did some phenomenal ones, right? They're pretty cool. But the whole time that ball is sitting in some popper waiting for you to finish a video mode, your ball time is going up. So, you know, every time the ball time is going up, the revenue for the game goes down to the operator. So you don't want to have long ball time. So if you're going to do that, you got to make up for it by making the game meaner. Just flat out. You know, there's a metric you want to achieve for ball time, and if you're holding that for a video mode, you got to take it out of the budget. That's not to say that they're not fun, but you got to make it up someplace else. And I think we talked about it a couple times, and I think the other part of it, honestly, was we just didn't really have a great idea for a video mode. You know, there's only so many things you can do with 2 buttons and a plunger, you know. Hey, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't set on having one, and Matt was pretty set against it, and that's, you know, we didn't, if we had some burning thing that, you know, we thought would be the greatest thing in the world, we would have, you know, put it in, but we didn't have it, and we had other things we were more worried about, like that center amp that we fought.
Okay, gentlemen.
Yeah, Tom, you said you always took home number 5. Are you allowed to take home great games you work on, or did you pay for them?
Oh no, I paid for them. Yeah, they were the Mel games, and they were always. But I always tried to get game number 5.
Okay, another question at the back.
Yeah. Was there ever a prototype that had a gun shooter instead of a plunger?
No,
there never was.
No.
Was it ever considered? It seems like a good theme for it.
Well, I'm kind of, you know, we can debate this a little bit, but I'm kind of a purist on pinball. I like a plunger. I just flat out like a plunger. It's something about pinball that, you know, when you start putting buttons in its place, It feels weird to me.
Okay.
I like the plunger.
Okay, last couple of questions, Martin.
I mean, they just from the beginning think about that old people are nearly drunk in that game. And so I think it's definitely funny. So everybody comes to my basement and says, "My, they are all drunk in that game, aren't they?" Did you start have this idea from the beginning?
Yeah, I think it was that we thought that there would be. So well, that wasn't the game. The Norwich was commenting like this, you know, so constantly. That's right. That's right. It was, so we kept with the drunk character in there. So. And it was a lot of fun. We did. We decided on a few different characters, whether or not we saw them. I think John Yossi ended up putting them in there. And then there's a faceless character that's the, my friends commonly call the Krusty Miner, that is always...
That always talks like this during the game, that always speaks and tells you what your score is.
So that's kind of the narrative to the game. So
and there was a lot more of the drunk guy. We pulled some of him out at some point. Because we had to make room for the other guys.
And so, I mean, I don't know that it's always full of it. It just might be the most memorable voice in it. So there are quite a few. Yeah, see, I'm hearing it back there. Somebody's playing.
It's in my mobile phone.
All right.
Thanks, guys. I'm going to draw the proceedings to a close now. What we're going to do is Jim would like to take some photos of the three of you, and then I'd also like to invite all the Williams employees, past and present, that are in the room to come up for a group photo, and then finally everyone... come up and shake hands and maybe have private words, ask those questions you didn't want to shout out. Okay, guys? So, thanks for taking the time to be here tonight, for giving us a